Welcome to Culture Bites, where we take culture theory and turn it into everyday insights. We're powered by Human Synergistics, and our mission is to change the world one organization at a time. We can only do that together with our amazing community, so thank you for listening. Welcome to Culture Bites. My name's Dominic Gawley. I'm a consultant with Human Synergistics Australia, and I'm joined on the podcast this week by our head of consulting, Corinne Cantor. Hey, Corinne.
Hey, Dom. How are you?
I'm really well, and I'm excited because we've got a special guest on the podcast this week, which is Max Martina, who's the president of Cambridge Leadership and Associates. Hey, Max.
Hey, Dom. Good to be here. Hi, Corinne.
Hey, Max.
Thanks for being here, Max. And I know you and Corinne met through a bit of work, Corinne.
Yeah. Super excited about this podcast, doing this with Max. Max and I met probably early 2023. It's crazy to think, Max, that almost 2 years that we've been working. So we've been working collaboratively on a project focusing on leadership development and specifically leadership as a practice. And so I have been very lucky to get a lot of exposure through Max to learn a bit more about adaptive leadership. And I have absolutely loved it. And I thought it would be fantastic for Max to come and join a podcast and share some of his wealth of experience and insight, specifically on adaptive leadership. And then I thought, Dom, where we might make the link back to constructive leadership. So happy to have you here, Max.
Corinne, what a pleasure. Dom, thanks for having me. It's truly a pleasure to be here. And as I've gotten to know you, Corinne, over the years, I can tell you that I'm just inspired by the way you show up in the room and how you do the work. So it really is a pleasure to be here today.
I'm excited because I've heard a lot about it, Max, from Corinne, from this program you guys have been working on together, as well as a little bit of controversy. So I heard you say before that there's no such thing as a leader. Tell me more.
Well, perhaps it's a cheeky way to grab some attention, but it stems from this idea that perhaps what most of us think of leadership is maybe not quite accurate. And so we could go down a big rabbit hole with this, but I'll give you a couple quick ideas that are maybe high-level summary points about this. So what we know about leadership, and of course, many of us think of that word in very sexy terms, it conjures the idea that, you know, we can be the savior for our kin, or we can engineer a solution and bring people into the promised land. But the reality is that when we think about what real leadership is, it turns out that there are some core distinctions that historically we haven't made. And so this idea that no one is a leader is maybe controversial, but what it gets down to is one of the core distinctions of adaptive leadership, which is that leadership is a set of practices. And so really, you're only a leader insofar as you practice leadership. And so this idea of no one is a leader is also connected to this idea that we often confuse the work of leadership with what we would call positional authority, two very distinct things.
Mm. Yeah. Tell me more on that, Max. So I guess the traditional view is, you know, you're a leader because you're in charge of people. You got people reporting into you. Mm.
Yeah. And it's not wrong to say that we need authorities in our lives. Our organizations, our governments, our businesses, our nonprofits, our families have positional authority. In fact, from the time we're born, we're raised in a climate and a culture that leans on the expertise and knowledge of our elders. And in fact, we're one of the few species, mammalian species, that leverages authority for our own survival. I think a giraffe can walk 17 minutes after it's born. So humans have a very complex relationship with authority. And unfortunately, as I said, we confuse this idea that leadership is authority. They're very distinct things. And when we make this distinction, Dom, what it enables us to do functionally is effectively practice leadership even when we don't have authority. And likewise, it also highlights how often when we're working with authorities, they may not practice leadership. Mm-hmm. So this interesting rub between who can practice leadership, how and when is it necessary? Mm. Making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I really love the distinction because I think in the work that we do, we see a lot of executives who actually rely on their authority to, you know, whether it's tell, direct, supervise, and there's not much leadership. And so I think it's an important distinction to make so that we can redirect the focus. Authority is kind of a given, you know, in terms of your job description, but leadership is not guaranteed. And so I think it's a really important languaging so that we can redirect attention to the practice and behavior.
Yeah, I agree, Corinne. And I think actually, if we don't make that distinction, we run the risk of a loss of agency in organizations. We defer to authority too often, which can actually have dangerous consequences, not only for organizations, but for societies. There are classic case studies, even multicultural examples, of how a deference or an over-deference to authority can lead to poor decision-making. And when we think about the role and work of leadership, one of the critical elements around leadership is that actually leadership isn't necessary to solve technical problems, you know, like changing a tire on a car, right?
Right.
Even complex technical problems like repairing your heart valve, for example, for which you don't need a leadership consultant. You need technical competence. You need trained authorities. You want a doctor who is competent in cardiovascular systems to be operating on your heart. So there's a time and a place where the practice of leadership is appropriate and where the practice of technical skill set and the application of technical skill sets is also appropriate. So I think that distinction begins to point to the functional role of the leadership practice. And as you said, Corinne, working with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of executives who have this mantle of authority, namely title, position, power, influence. And yet the practices of leadership can be quite elusive. So when we frame it that way, we have to drill down a little bit more deeply to say, well, what does it look like? What are we actually doing in the work of leadership? And a lot of people don't make that distinction.
Do you think, Max, that sometimes, or let me ask you this, when is authority an example of leadership in practice? So we've made a distinction. Are there times when authority is part of, the use of authority is part of the practice?
Yeah, great question. So I think the answer is yes, which is to say that authority isn't bad, right? Authority confers some really valuable services to the folks that are under it, right? Authorities can direct resources. They can protect people. They can create clarity when confusion exists. I'll never forget, you know, when the pandemic struck several years ago, April, in our world, April 2024, approximately, people leaned on authority. They wanted assurances of what we need to do. Where do I go? What do I do? How do I protect myself? And so the country and most of the globe, frankly, went through a period of what we call acute crisis. So during moments of acute crisis, authority has a really powerful role. And we could even go deeper with this distinction, and it sounds perhaps too academic or theoretical, but we make the distinction between both formal authority and informal authority. So title, positional power, these are examples of what we would call formal authority by virtue of the office I'm inhabiting or by virtue of the power granted to me, I have formal authority. And it's useful. It can help executives and individuals call attention to critical issues. But in and of itself, doesn't necessarily solve complex adaptive problems, as we might call that.
Yeah.
And then I might add real quickly, you know, the idea of informal authority is a little bit different. So when we think about folks, executives even, who have both formal authority and informal authority, what we're talking about there are individuals who have the experience, perhaps the credibility, the history of an organization, the ones that people tend to listen to sift the confusion away from the clarity. And so there's a difference, right, between these things. And we kind of know it when we feel it, right? How are we cultivating informal authority in the context of organizations? Yeah, really can be heady stuff when we're thinking about it academically.
I'm laughing a little bit, folks, because we actually can't see each other. So it's a little bit tricky to see when to speak. And Dom, what I was going to do is just make a connection with the work that we do on culture, because I think that's a good example where what we know with our research and where companies have been really successful in creating culture change have got the buy-in of the CEO or the president. And what we've seen in our research is that it's important for the CEO, the president, to use their authority to sort of authorize the change, because when they do that, they make resources available, but it's also encouraging people to do something different. You know, to all intents and purposes, it's actually to act in a way that is counter the current culture. And so it provides a bit of cover for them. So it's one example where I think the formal authority as leadership practice works and needed in culture change. When we measure culture, interestingly, Max, when you talked about the different types of authority, there are two things that we measure around leadership and culture. One is organizational basis of power. So the questions are essentially, why do people do what their leader or their boss tells them? And so if it's about organizational base of power, I'm doing it because you're my manager and you can fire me, you can promote me, you can increase my salary. So I'm doing it because you're my boss. The other type of power that we look at is personal basis of power. So the reason that I'm doing what you asked me to do, Max, as my boss, is that I value your opinion. I respect you. I think you know what you're doing. And I'm doing it because you're Max, not just because you're my boss. So that two things that we actually measure when we're looking at culture.
Yeah. I love that, Corinne. And maybe different language for the same idea, which is what's the distinction between formal authority and informal authority? And what are those behaviors that allow for personal power? And it occurs to me that one of the practices of adaptive leadership, if someone were to say, well, what do I do in a context where there's ambiguity or volatility or uncertainty? One of the things that we begin to think about from a practice standpoint is how do we create what we would call a holding environment? And so I think this is one of the central tasks of both culture creation and leadership inside of organizational systems, which is to say, what behaviors can we deploy to strengthen the environment for people to both have agency, to experiment, and to innovate? And I do think that holding environments and creating effective holding environments is really a central task of leadership and culture creation. How does that resonate with what you see?
Completely. And it was funny because Dom and I, before the podcast, before you came on, we're talking about the role of leadership in creating a holding environment. Would you say a bit more about that? Like when you talk about a holding environment, what are the different elements of that?
Yeah, great. So, Corinne, you've heard me use this metaphor before, and I love metaphors. So forgive me for overusing it perhaps, but we have at home an Instapot, which is a pressure cooker. And it's a really phenomenal device, because you can cook a roast in literally a quarter of the time. And, you know, for a while in the 50s and 60s, they fell out of style because they actually were not made very well. So a pressure cooker could be dangerous. If the vessel didn't hold the pressure strongly enough, then it could actually explode. We actually saw this in the United States in the Boston Marathon bombing. Unfortunately, someone used a pressure cooker to kill innocent people. So the metaphor is apropos, because when we think about leadership, part of what we want to inculcate and support is the creation of the habits, patterns, and behaviors that allow people to tolerate sufficient levels of stress so that they can get real work done. And when I say real work, part of what I'm inferring is that the work of leadership is mobilizing people to do difficult work, solve complex problems, right? And I think this is just so fascinating, because if any of us have ever confronted a complex problem for which really there are no obvious answers or solutions, it's hard to know where to go, right? And yet this is exactly the work of what real leadership requires. So the process by which we create a stronger holding environment is, you know, not one and done. It's not formulaic. It's how do we inure the people that work with us and for us to the conditions and the environment where they could tolerate sufficient levels of stress, so that what? So that we could cook the roast faster, or in this case, so we could really progress complex challenges and difficult work. So part of that holding environment creation is safe to fail, right? Can we fail quickly and fail forward? Do I have agency to experiment and innovate? Can I try new things? Am I heard and respected and valued? Is my opinion valuable? Am I receiving feedback in a timely and efficient manner so that I can make corrections to my own and make adjustments and corrections to my own behaviors? So these things are all, obviously, they're components of that holding environment piece. And when I work with executives who are building culture, we have many conversations around, what are you doing to engage that muscle set? You know, often it takes many iterations. It's not just a one and done thing. I think about the blue color zone, right, on the LSI and what that means. And I think there's a common language here. I think there's some crossover. Is that fair to say?
Massive crossover, Max. And I mean, it's a massive crossover of both leadership and culture, because what you're talking about is leaders creating the cultural environment where people can take a risk, you know, where it's encouraged to take a calculated risk, try things, give it a go, learn from our mistakes and go again.
Yeah.
Absolutely crucial.
I was just going to say too, I think that if I relate it back to culture, then, well, before I do that, I think one of the things is, I think sometimes people who hold leadership roles get so immersed in activity, the technical challenges, the technical problem, that it can be easy to lose sight of their role, which is really to help the organization evolve and to lead from the gap between current state and future state. Mm-hmm. And which is why leadership is about mobilizing, right? Because staying in the current state's not going to help you evolve, help the organization and its people evolve. So it's not just the organization, is you help your people evolve and teams evolve and the organization moves forward. One of the things that I thought was interesting, Dom, when I think about the model of the circumplex, is that when a culture is very passive, and in our model that would come up as green, if you think about the pressure cooker idea, there is no pressure. So there's no cooking in the organization. There's not a whole lot of movement. And the risk is that you, as an, you're stagnant, you know, you can't. And I think in times like that, then the task of leadership is to increase the level of intensity and to use challenge, you know, creating challenges to lift the intensity, but keep people in a learning zone. Whereas, you know, in times when things are really intense, there's a lot of change, multiple restructures, maybe the business isn't doing well, then they're right at the top of their, probably just before the terror zone. That's when leaders have to start making it safer, you know, create more, sort of meet people more, check in more, increase the level of safety. And so leadership then is really this process of lifting and lowering, is how I kind of think about it as well.
As Corinne was speaking, I had the image of a steam train in my head and shoveling the coals in, you know, so, hey, we've got to turn up the pressure, probably literally in that case, to speed up. But then if we're coming to the downhill or the station or whatever, they need to start slowing it down as well as not over boiling the water.
Mm.
Well, and I think from the dynamic or from the standpoint of human behavior change, which is where a lot of this work is founded and based on, you know, there are so many apt metaphors, whether it's losing 10 pounds, kilos, 2 kilos, the transfer, or, you know, getting stronger in the gym. I mean, there's actually a set of biological processes as well. We could call that eustress, positive stress, right? What is the productive level of what we call disequilibrium?
Yes.
Which suggests that there's actually a place for each of us where a little bit of stress, maybe a lot of bit of stress for some of us, is actually really productive. And it's productive because it builds muscle capacity. It builds cardiovascular endurance. It helps us lose an extra pound. But when is it too much, right? What is that limit of tolerance? And what is not enough? And ironically, so much of about the practice of leadership is being able to appropriately calibrate on behalf of our people the correct levels of engagement and stress to support growth. So really, the work of leadership is also about development, right? As you said, Corinne, it's really about developing our people.
Mm.
Very selfless work.
I always think of Kenny Rogers showing my age, you know, not that I listen much to country music, but I always think of you've got to know when you got to know when to hold, you got to know when to fold.
I
think that's a good philosophy on life, but I always think of it, you know, I talk to leaders about that as well. It's managing the tension between growth and protection, challenge and safety.
Yeah, I love that as well, because I think people often mistake being constructive for being nice. And I don't think it's the same thing. You know, being nice and this is not having any pressure, you know, like dropping off the pressure, not enough. No, constructive is challenging, but it's challenging to the right level for the right reasons. So we're going to have ambitious goals. We're going to go after them. We're expected to give things a go and make decisions. And there's some pressure that comes with that. It's not overcooking it. We're you know, dropping into the terror zone, I think you called it, Corinne, which is too far. Max, I'd be interested, because at the start you talked about it's not the formal authority but the practice of leadership. And we talked about creating the holding environment. I'd be interested in what some of those other practices are. And I noted you mentioned
It was about solving complex adaptive problems. So I'd love to learn more about those two things.
Yeah, great, great, Tom. Let me just backtrack one quick second, and I would say add to your last comment, which is quite insightful, this idea that we don't always get it right, right? Mm. If we're practicing leadership from a position of authority, we may not get it right. And mistakes are okay if we're learning. So I think that becomes really essential for anyone practicing leadership. Yeah, and I think to your point, this idea of leadership as a set of practices, the good news is, you know, like a carpenter or a cellist, we can get better if we practice. If we engage in the behaviors in an intentional way, we can actually improve our practice. So we've codified a list of 34 practices of leadership, right? And these are things that people can do in their daily lives with intentionality and commitment. And I'll cover a couple for you, and then maybe we talk about this distinction between technical versus adaptive problems. So oftentimes, right, when organizations are called to deal with complex problems, people often don't know where to start. And so confusion reigns supreme in cases like that. And so one of the first things we actually ask individuals to practice and deploy is this idea of holding steady, right? It's how do you find the resolve and the inner fortitude to be in a place where you are in the work, but not of the work, so to speak, so that the tension is an ability, you can leverage the tension in a productive way. So this idea of holding steady is a practice, right? Which is really about inside out leadership. How do you come to this place where your inner world is such that you can tolerate the stresses of the holding environment in a way that allows you to think clearly and productively? So that might be one. A second, I'll just cover three here. A second would be what we call getting to the balcony. So much of effective leadership practice is about a reflective consciousness. And that means the capacity to see yourself and your environment. So the simple metaphor of walking away from the dance floor where we spend 90 or 95% of our time in the minutiae of execution, upstairs to the bandstand to spend just 5% of our time looking down where we can see so clearly, right? We can see the ticket takers, we can see the dancers, we can see the band. And it gives us such a healthy perspective about the system structurally, and not only structurally, but our own drivers and motivators. And then a third would be the idea of connecting to purpose. So helping your people orient to the essential work of the change that you're orienting towards. I think without good purpose, without a solid foundation in purpose, we lean into the losses that we're experiencing too deeply. And it's hard. It's really hard to move forward. So those are three quick ideas on practice. And at the risk of being too long-winded, this distinction between technical versus adaptive problems. So we make this distinction primarily because, and some people call them wicked problems, but primarily because adaptive problems often don't have a clear solution. And when we encounter them, we're flummoxed, we're troubled, and we don't know how to proceed. So when we identify an adaptive problem, the first step is to recognize it so that we can pull back and say, wait a second, we may not have the answers here. So what will it take to move forward in a productive way?
Just curious on that, Max, and thinking about the, you know, there's no such thing, well, no person is a leader by authority. Does that mean, I'm thinking about like the day-to-day running of an organization, you know, so it's the business as usual, things we do every week. Does that fall under the leadership bucket or is that somewhere else in your view?
I think most of that work is essential and important. And I would call a lot of that management work. So in my world, even the most senior executives, you know, they're expected to practice leadership all of the time. But the reality is the best and the brightest are practicing leadership, which is to say, committing to practices where leadership helps mobilize people to solve complex problems, perhaps 30% of their time. And 30% of the time is, I think, generous because most of us have lives outside of work. And in our professional context, we have to execute. And we have to file expense reports, or we have to work with folks on technical problem solving. So really, in my experience, the world-class individuals who are practicing leadership are doing so at best 30% of their time, which means that they're right. They're proactively creating holding environments 30% of their time. What do you think of that, Corinne?
Yeah, I think I'm interested. I'm thinking about the 30%. I think how I'm making sense of it for myself, I'll test this with you guys, is that I think that the authority is required in a role when it comes to decision making. So the organization gives you authority to make decisions and to be the accountable, like ultimately you know, it makes you accountable for something. However, the leadership is needed to motivate, to mobilize, and to, so it's almost like the process of getting there is where leadership, I think, kicks in, as well as the fact that we do have management tasks. So even when there are technical problems, it doesn't mean that the person, the executive, has to be the one that solves it, right? If they're practicing leadership, they're actually creating an environment, a holding environment, and motivating and coaching and helping their people get to the answer themselves. And so that they're developing them and stretching them so that they don't really need to keep doing that. So that's one of the ways that I think authority is important in terms of crisis or, you know, chaos. Then people are looking for some authority to protect or provide direction or create order. But I think that when it comes to the BAU of leadership, leaving aside that, you know, we've got some tasks that we might need to do, that leadership is motivating others to help them solve. Even if we're required in the technical problem-solving process, we don't have to be front and center in it. Yes. And I think that sometimes leaders, you know, we see a lot of executives get caught from good intent wanting to add value, is what I call it. And the way that they want to add value is sort of weigh in on a technical problem discussion, but they may not actually be needed. And in fact, what ends up happening sometimes is they kind of crowd out, you know, through purely good intent. But because their office has some authority that comes with it, we can see deferring going on.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And I think more and more, it's interesting when we think about it, Max, though, I think that in this environment, you know, there's so much going on in the world, isn't there? There's so much going on. And I'm not quite sure. Well, I know there's a lot going on in the US, but, you know, in Australia, there's a lot of consolidating. There's a bit of contraction. And I was reflecting recently that there isn't one person that I work with, organization, that who isn't going through a transformation, some level of volatility, you know, multiple restructures. And so I think this idea of, you know, 30% of leadership, I think it's getting harder for leaders to find a still point from which that they can hold steady to be able to provide, you know, that leadership.
Boy, I resonate with that, Corinne. Often think that, you know, we have so much change and volatility in the world that you and I are never going to be out of work for very long if that were to come to it. There's so much that needs doing, right? In my view, you know, the practice of leadership is a powerful ameliorative influence that absolutely, I mean, I've seen it not just change companies, but impact marriages and families and organized nonprofits. And so this idea that leadership is both individual, but also interpersonal and organizational, that it transcends, you know, your title, is just profoundly powerful. And I'll also agree with you that, you know, authority is important. I'm not suggesting that authority isn't important. You know, in this country, we just had a presidential election, and elections and campaigns are never about leadership. They're always about gaining authority, right? And so authority comes with some really big, powerful nuggets, right? We can command attention. We can direct resources. We can call attention to the issues that we're concerned about. But in and of itself, very distinct, right? The practices that you're talking about, the ones that are so hard to do in such a noisy world, it's a separate set of behaviors. And I think if we're intentional and we begin to think about what those behaviors are, my gosh, the executives that I work with that do this extremely well are increasingly letting go, increasingly transferring, increasingly empowering individuals to grow and develop and build capacity. Because at the end of the day, isn't that what leadership is really about, which is building capacity? Building capacity for revenue, for innovation, for peace, right? For prosperity, right? So I think there's so much good that comes from leadership as we're talking here.
It's remarkable, though, I don't know if you see this, but we still see in Australia a lot of people being promoted to leadership positions for their technical expertise.
Absolutely.
Still happening.
Yeah.
Still happening.
Yep.
The way I almost think of it, listening to what you say, is if I have to rely on because I say so, you know, like my formal authority, then I've kind of failed as a leader. or at least in the practices. Yeah. You know, I've fallen back onto because I have the formal authority, therefore you have to do it. It means I've probably missed a trick somewhere. And I was wondering earlier with it's kind of where my question around the business as usual stuff was going, and Corinne brought up the example of culture change earlier. That's a really tricky leadership problem to tackle, because the challenge is, I think, people have to step outside of the culture. And so when you're talking about getting on the balcony, that's what I was hearing a little bit of. We can't be on the dance floor. We need to step outside in order to go somewhere new and different.
Love that, Dom.
Yeah, it's so hard. It's so hard. And yet, Dom, wherever we find ourselves, we are part of a system. And ironically, this goes back to a lot of the work in systems thinking. When you're part of a system, you see from the perspective of the system. So intrinsically, it's very hard to step out of that. It requires tremendous foresight and separation in some cases to be able to have that reflexive capacity. The part of what Corinne said earlier is that we're often seeing in organizations, individuals being rewarded and then promoted, right? Rewarded with promotions for their technical competence, when in reality, the competencies of leadership and even management to some extent are very different than the technical competencies of execution in the trenches. Mm. So totally agree with both of you on those on those ideas. Yeah.
And interestingly, I'd go further in saying that sometimes while we may be engaged on culture work by leadership, sometimes I think they don't actually realize how much work they are going to have to do, because they have succeeded in the culture. You know, they've successfully navigated it. And so sometimes subconsciously they're invested in parts of the culture that they want to stay the same way. And so that's some of the work that we need to do with them, is to help them realize that to understand what cultural change, leading a cultural change, will mean for them and their behavior. And just one thing that I just wanted to touch on, and it goes back to one of the practices you were saying, which is connecting to purpose. And you talked a bit about when we don't have a strong purpose, we identify, we start to get attached more to loss. I think that is so important, because what I love about that principle, that idea, is that if you can help people to reflect on what story are they attaching to, what story is in their head? Is it a loss story or is it a purpose story, or what are they connected to most? Then the wonderful thing about that is you can rewrite the narrative. You know, you can rewrite the story that's going through your head to make it more helpful. So I don't think it's ever a kind of a leap from loss to purpose, but it is about finding what's my next, you know, how do I move towards a sense of purpose that I'm excited by, that I'm motivated by, and it makes it helps me stay the course, you know, with some of the difficult work that needs to be done.
Totally agree. And I think it's perhaps remiss if I didn't mention this, and it sounds doom and gloom, but it's really worth repeating. And that is that, or maybe saying the first time, that when we think about change, most of us, you know, have this kind of gut instinct that it's bad. And yet for many of us, there is positive change. And so when we're in organizational systems that are changing, right, or even economic systems that are changing, and people begin to identify the losses that are impacting them directly, or perhaps the fear of future losses, it actually contributes to not only avoiding doing the real work, but in some cases, casualties. And I use that word explicitly, because it's, you know, the work of leadership is actually quite difficult, and it's risky business, because in many cases, when you're asking people to accept the losses associated with compelling change, my gosh, you know, you're asking people to lose their job. You're asking people to deal with a loss of competence or stability, not just, you know, economic realities. So this gets at the heart of the human psyche around how do we deal with change and loss specifically. So while, you know, it sounds easy to say, well, we can motivate with purpose, you know, what do you say to the disenfranchised population? I worked with a good friend of mine who was working on the problem of AIDS in Africa, which has had a resurgence in recent years. And you know, historically in many countries there, the problem has been left to the women to deal with, right? Sex education and prophylactics. And what they've realized is that actually we have to target other populations. We have to speak to the men in these communities. We have to speak to tribal elders. And when they broadened their focus, they realized that the losses associated with those communities were different, right? And so how do you speak to that purpose?
Yeah.
Well, it's a different conversation, right? So we have to be almost detectives and listening so deeply to the system to find out what is, you know, what is important to these factions and these stakeholders.
And I was just going to build on that, because one of the things that I feel very strongly about actually is I think that there are some inconvenient truths that happen in change, and that we are either turn a blind eye to. And one of the things is that I think that there's an emotional labor involved in providing effective leadership, particularly all the time, but particularly in change. And I think what I've seen is that organizations and senior executives are very uncomfortable with looking into the pain that comes with that change. Now, and unfortunately what happens is what I see happen is that the organization does a fantastic job at broadcasting what we're doing, why we're doing, why we have to do it, and this is what's important about it. And just, you know, really crossing their fingers and hoping that people will buy that story and will jump on board. Now, of course, some people will, but one person who's fearing the loss of their job won't. And I think we do ourselves, the organization does itself and does its people a disservice by not finding a way to give expression to those fears and concerns. And I think, look, I understand it, because I think that rather than say anything wrong or make anything worse, we end up saying nothing. And then what happens, it goes underground and it acts out in other ways. But I think that part of it is because we don't acknowledge the emotional work that actually we're asking our leaders to do. And so I think, you know, I'm really passionate about bringing that to the surface, because I think it is more manageable than we think. But we have to have the courage to do it.
I agree with you. And therein lies a few of the reasons why I think finding the practice of leadership is so rare, because it's risky, it's difficult, it's challenging. And connected to another practice that we think about, it's perhaps the same way to say what you just said so eloquently, Corinne, which is this idea of identifying what we call patterns of work avoidance, which sounds like a mouthful, but it's this idea that when people are confronted with losses, right, they tend to avoid the real work. So if we're in a position of authority asking to practice leadership, one of our jobs is to listen for the losses. Where are people avoiding doing the real work? And if we can't acknowledge that, uncover it, connect to the losses, address the losses, acknowledge the casualties on some level, then ultimately we're actually doing a disservice to the organization, or at the very least, we're not helping the organization evolve, right? To your point, we haven't dealt with the emotional fallout.
When you say real work, Max, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, I think that's what Corinne is getting at, which is contending with the elements that prevent us from making progress in a context. So it really depends, Dom, on the situation. So for example, working with a public company that just went private, it was acquired by a private equity firm. And in those contexts, you know, the losses are massive. But from a management lens, it's just a numbers game, right? If you're a frontline employee where 25% of the people are going to lose their job, you know, very different losses versus if you're working for a nonprofit like we do in the city of Seattle that works with homeless youth, the losses they're confronting are quite different. It's the loss of resources. It's the loss of engagement from community members. And so I think the work changes based on the environment that you're in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You've seen that, Corinne?
Yeah, I do. And I'm thinking of examples where, for example, a business changes its operating model or maybe a business acquires another business. And typically what would happen is a commitment's made at a boardroom level about when savings are going to be realized, and then that shapes everything else. And so where we get caught up on is what we can cut versus the real work there is identifying where's the potential for growth and how do we change. And it could be that what's actually required is a mindset shift in the culture.
Yes.
To go, yep. say, from yep. providing products to solution. And so I think the real work there is being avoided in order to meet, you know, a commitment that's been made without necessarily being fully aware or cognizant of what the actual work needs to get done.
Yes. Well said. Can we identify the real work of leadership is sometimes half of the work of leadership, right? In other words, if we're going to mobilize a change in human behavior to evolve, right, so that we can tackle complex problems, whether it's innovation or product development or revenue creation or, you know, reducing AIDS in Africa, my gosh, we better be conversant with the elements that impede that, right? And that's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
because you're asking people to confront it. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And I would say in our sort of context that we work in more with culture, I think a lot of the time we see a great strategy being developed and then implemented. But the real work in ensuring that strategy gets delivered is actually in the culture, you know, because very often a strategy doesn't survive first contact with the culture. The culture will determine the degree, the pace at which execution happens. So I think that's an example in our context, Dom, where I think, you know, the culture is the real work, but what we're paying attention to is the IT system that we're bringing in or, you know, the change in the business operating model.
Which is a proxy for the technical solution, which we know how to solve in some cases.
It's
the cleaner work, I suppose, you know, like that's has a technical solution. And so that feels easier to tackle. Whereas the other one, it's murky.
Yeah.
But that's where leadership's needed. That's
Well, and of course, the reality is most complex problems are a mixture of both, right? There is highly detailed technical work, and then there's complex human behavior adaptive work that's connected to culture. And sometimes, you know, we misdiagnose one for the other. We think that the technical work is the adaptive work or vice versa. And I often say that the common reason for leadership failure is treating an adaptive challenge like a technical problem and then effectively misdiagnosing it. I mean, if you walked into the doctor's office and said, I have a pain in my elbow, and the doctor said, let's get you straight to surgery, you'd say, wait a second, what about an x-ray, right? And she'd say, no, I've done this 1,000 times before, let's go straight to surgery. You'd say, wait, hold on, I want an MRI or a second opinion. So sometimes the work of leadership is, can we be diagnostic in identifying those losses and articulating the cultural implications of the decisions we're asking people to commit to?
I love it, Max. I feel like we could probably talk for hours on this.
Me too.
The one that jumped out, I love you said a little bit ago about it's leadership is risky, difficult, and challenging. And I think it is. It's kind of simple. The idea is simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah. Well said, Dom. And I think for any of us that have been in positions where we're asked to provide leadership, facilitate, you know, work through complex problems, gosh, it feels challenging. You're on the hot seat. You're expected to be, you know, the savior and the solution provider. And yet you realize that the real work is about building capacity in the people who need to develop new skills, right? So it's not so simple. It's messy. It's messy and it's dangerous. If we're doing it right, that is.
I love it. I think it's just a good reminder for all of us of, you know, as leaders, are we getting on that balcony? Are we doing the real work? You know, are we holding steady? Are we connecting to purpose? And I know there's more to it than just those, but I think even those are just a great reflection for listeners of this podcast of, you know, where am I at? Am I spending that 30% time actually leading versus just managing today?
Yeah. Never easy stuff, right?
It's never easy. It's
situationally dependent, context appropriate and relevant. So every situation's unique. And I think, unfortunately, for those of us in this business that try to prescribe solution sets, we fall into the trap of the technical diagnostic work, which isn't really leadership. So,
Great note to end on, Max. Thank you so much for your time today and sharing your insights around adaptive leadership.
My pleasure. Dom, Corinne, thank you so much. Great to be with you today.
Wonderful.
See ya. Thanks for listening to this episode of Culture Bites. If you enjoy the show, remember to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, leave us a review. It helps other people to find the show. If you have a question you'd like us to answer, email podcast@human-synergistics.com.au. We'd love to answer it. This podcast is copyright by Human Synergist 6 Australia, all rights reserved. To learn more about what we do, visit human-synergistics.com.au.